You're listening to a podcast from DCT Audio. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been producing audio content for over 10 years. Thank you for listening to this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. So I'm delighted to say that I've been joined today by Charlotte Dugdale. Charlotte, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I always like to start with exploring a guest's childhood, as I think it can help to inform future life experiences. So would you be able to share just a little bit of that with us?
I had a relatively normal childhood, I would say. My parents were wonderful, hardworking. I have a brother and a sister, older. I'm the youngest. I had a great childhood. We travelled a lot to America when we were younger, which was really nice with some of my dad's work. He's also a landscape gardener at the same time, but he writes a few books, my dad. And yeah, I was always quite a sporty child. School, it was kind of here nor there. I didn't really care too much about school. I cared more about playing sport and going outside, playing with other kids, that kind of thing. And nothing too crazy happened within my childhood, if I'm honest. And I suppose we're probably going to get into this a little bit later. When I've always, since as long as I can remember, I've always struggled with anxiety as a child. It came very prevalent within my teenage years. So I think that's why maybe sport and all of those things were quite a big part of my life, because they leveled me out in a way. But apart from that, no, I had a great, happy childhood.
Isn't it interesting? You talk about anxiety, and there can be all sorts of causes why people do get anxious. I suppose no real reason to suffer from anxiety from what you've seen as a child. So why do you think that kind of manifested itself in you?
Oh, well, you tell me. I wish I knew. I was with a counsellor the other year and she said, oh, we need to find a place where it happened. And I was like, I honestly cannot pinpoint it. I genuinely feel it's just within me.
It could be a chemical imbalance
I think that could be the case here. And I think it's just always been there. I've always gone through the kind of waves of either low mood, anxiety, feeling great. And then it's just continued throughout my entire life. And I can remember being in high school and feeling it, not really knowing what it was. And nobody really spoke about it then. You know, it's way more out in the open now.
Mm.
Whereas back then it was, oh, no, she's, you know, she's just a bit weird.
They were all a bit weird. Well, you began your working career supporting people with drug and alcohol addiction in prisons and later social care, I believe, which I think can give us a clue as to the sort of caring person you are, I suppose. But that work came at a price, didn't it? And I wonder if you could share some of your own mental health challenges at that time.
Ah, yes. So I started, I'm trying to think of dates off the top of my head. On the way here, I was trying to pinpoint everything so I wouldn't forget. I always wanted to work with criminal behaviour. It was always my aim. And no offence to yourself, I never wanted to go in the police.
I don't blame you.
The police it wasn't where I wanted to go. I wanted to work more in the psychology within prison. So when I went to university, I studied forensic psych. And I would have loved to have gone on to do a master's there, but I couldn't afford it. And I couldn't, after finishing my dissertation and all of that, I couldn't bring myself to carry on in education, if I'm being completely honest. So I moved into drug and alcohol work in prisons in the Northwest, quite a few different prisons. And I loved it. I loved it so much. I worked with young offender males, I worked with older males, and then I worked with females, both young and older. And I found the work really fulfilling. I found that the people that I was working with are kind of ostracized from society, and they are not all, but from the moment they're born, a lot of these people are born into poverty and into these scenarios, which the general public, in inverted commas, don't see, and they're not a part of, and they're totally misunderstood. And I found that these people, they're just normal. They are normal people. They've just done bad things. And whether or not that was from, you know, an innate badness or trauma or all of these things, I just found it so interesting, so fulfilling, in the sense of you can work with these people, you can make their lives better, you can give them a little bit of hope. But the thing for me with my mental health is it wasn't the work with the people. It wasn't the work with those ladies in prison or whether it was the children in social care. It was the organisation of the organisation that I found the most stressful.
That's really interesting you say that, because that is a hot topic at the moment with police-related trauma. Not so much the incidents that officers are attending, but the organisation that they're working for.
Yeah. So I left prisons in, off the top of my head, maybe 15 years ago. And then I moved into social care. And both of those organisations then were a mess, were a complete mess. And I'm not saying that from the managers were a mess and the people who worked there were bad, because they weren't. They were excellent. They were such amazing people. It was the funding. It was the overload. It was the constantly piling on to the staff that was just crazy. It was crazy. And that was the kind of point of the decline.
It is interesting. What alarms me, what you've said, is that 15 years ago.
I know, yeah.
Nothing's changed.
Nope. It's probably got worse.
Nothing's changed. So how did that day-to-day basis, how did that affect you then?
So I am not a trained social worker. I didn't go into social care as a social worker. And hats off to people who become social workers. I went in as a family support worker. So we worked in a team that was just below the highest level of social care, with the, where there'd be lots of court attendances and things like that. So we were preventing them from going up into the main or the big area of children's social care. And I worked with parents who use drugs, children who use drugs, and then started to move into a lot of domestic violence, which comes hand in hand with the drugs and alcohol. So I'd go in the morning and they'd say, okay, so my caseload should have been, say, 30 for over a week. And that is the standard where you can get work done. You can visit families at least once a week. You can get your reports written. You can do all of those things. I think at one point I was over 60 families. It's been a long time now. I can't remember the section number. They should have been with the social workers in the team above us. Very dangerous situations for children, you know, having to attend court dates, things like that, which I'm not trained to do that, but I was kind of pushed into that. Overcapacity. And I was struggling. And I was living in London at the time, which is a struggle anyway. It's a fantastic place to live, but you have no money. Even if you earn a good wage, you can't go out every evening and see friends. You can't do those things. So you're on a budget anyway. I used to go home and cry, because I used to take my laptop home, try and do the work at home. My mind would be frazzled. Then I'd go in the next day. They'd expect you to go in early because the reports wouldn't write themselves. They had to be written, because you're saving children's lives, essentially, and you're trying to make that better. I remember saying to my boss when I had an appraisal, you can't give me any more cases. They say, yeah, we understand. A week later, 10 more on your desk. And you think, something's got to give. And it did with me. From that job, I got signed off. I got signed off twice. Did I get signed off twice? I was signed off once because I was living with my friends. And I woke up one day and I hadn't washed my hair in a long time. I wasn't eating properly. I was kind of in a daze. I wasn't communicating. I wasn't talking. My friend says, you need to go to the doctor. You are not well. And I went to the doctor and they said, you are not going back to work. And I said, no. I've just got to call my boss because I've got to hand over these things. And they said, that's what bosses are for. They can deal with that. You're taking at least a month off. And I remember that week, they kept calling me. My managers kept calling me. My doctor had said to me, you do not answer the phone. You don't answer the phone because they're going to be asking you about work and this is your time to not go in. But they kept calling.
Don't get it, do they?
No.
They don't get it.
I found within social care, community drug and alcohol teams, you are a number and that's it. No matter how many times, whichever system I was in, whichever place I was working, the final place I worked, and this was when I made the change to go into my full-time yoga teaching. And again, I loved working in community drug and alcohol. I loved the people. I love what you could do. I love the trust you could build with people who have just been pushed out of society. No matter how many times I said to the manager, you're giving us too many cases. I can't see these people. I can't do any work. And then in the end, I put my resignation on her desk that morning. She said, no, Charlotte. And I said, yeah. And she was like, we'll do anything. We'll pay you more. And I said, will you give me less cases? And I said, even if you do, it's too late. I can't do it anymore.
There's a saying or a phrase that my counsellor said to me. And she said, Dave, you can't get better in the environment that made you ill.
No.
And you have to leave.
Yeah.
There's no other way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that very nicely brings us on to yoga.
Oh, yes.
And so you discovered yoga. Perhaps you could explain to us what yoga is, first of all, and how that helped you personally.
Wow, what is yoga? How long do you have? we'll have to contact a guru for this.
Well, what does it mean to you?
Yeah. So I discovered yoga when I was working in Manchester. And like I said earlier, I've always loved sports, going to the gym, keeping myself fit and active, running, whatever that was. When I was very stressed at work, I was in the gym one day. And I saw a yoga class and I thought in my head, someone says yoga is really good for your head. So I wandered into this Ashtanga class and it changed my life. It was something I had never experienced before. Whether you've done Ashtanga before or not, and what it could be any yoga class, but mine specifically was Ashtanga, the focus in the room, the silence, the breathing, the movement into all these really tough positions. And I remember at the end of that first class, I thought, oh my God, I haven't thought about anything for the past hour.
I remember doing my very first class with you and all I remember was being absolutely knackered. I thought, it's not doing my well-being any good, this.
I apologise for that. I think, for me, the yoga has an ability to switch my mind off in that moment. And if I have done a practice, whether that's meditation, whether it's pranayama, whether it's an asana practice, I can tell I've done it over the course of the next few hours because my mind is more steady. As someone with a very chaotic brain, I find that it just levels me out completely. I'm not here to say that yoga fixes everything. I'm not one of those yoga teachers because it doesn't, but it certainly helps the mind calm. Whichever channel of yoga that is, there's a misconception that it is just a lot of bendy women in a room, but we can talk about maybe a yin class, a hatha class, a ashtanga, a rocket, whichever area of asana you like. It could be meditation, it could be yoga nidra, it can be anything in that scope of the yoga. And it enables me personally to calm down, which I've never been able to do in my life.
I know yoga is thousands of years old, mm-hmm. and it would be easy to blame the modern life of the instant fix, doom scrolling, mobile phones. Well, they didn't have all that thousands of years ago. So I wonder what was going on in life in India that made them feel the need to practice yoga.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because life was probably a lot harder, but also a lot simpler.
Yeah. Again, I don't know the answers to this. It, you can only kind of think through possibilities of this, but life is hard in this day and age. You know, we're constantly told, get up at 5 a.m., make sure you have an ice plunge, don't drink coffee anymore, make sure that you're drinking matcha, or go to work, and if you're not working 12 hours a day, you're not succeeding. After that, you have to go to the gym, you have to do a HIIT class, and then you have to go for a walk after your tea, you know? And we're constantly told to be doing and doing and doing, when in actual fact, yoga tells you you don't have to be doing all the time. You just have to be in the moment.
Doing nothing is actually doing something.
Well, yeah, I suppose it is. There's a misconception that yoga teachers are perfect, and we're not. We are not. But how often do you get up in the morning, you go downstairs, you maybe go to the toilet, then you go and put the kettle on, you make yourself a cup of tea, cup of coffee, you put in a slice of toast, you put your bread, you eat it, then you get in your car and you're on your way to whether it's work, an appointment or whatever, completely mindlessly. You don't quite know how you've got to the car. You've just done it on autopilot.
It's that journey home and you don't remember it.
Yeah, exactly. The majority of people, myself included, do that day in, day out. It's in my mind because we're exploring it in my class this week. There's a really nice kind of philosophy in Zen. It's Zen philosophy, and it's called a beginner's mind. And it's even if you have done something over and over again, if you've done it a million times, you've drank a cup of tea a million times, think of the one that you're doing right now as if it's the first one you've ever had.
That's incredible, because listening to you, I was thinking, right, I've got a really good example that I had with a Tai Chi teacher. And it's exactly what you just said. It starts off as experience the feeling of your feet on the ground. So all these things are cumulative. So once you've done that, just listen, not to the thoughts in your head, but just listen to what's around you. We were in a forest at the time. I said, right, well, just look at the trees. Imagine you're looking at that tree the first time you've ever seen a tree. God, it was hard.
And I bet it was beautiful.
But it really was. Yeah. And it's all designed to stop that flywheel that's your mind and all those thoughts that come in and come out.
I was doing some reading over the weekend, because I do when I have themes in class, and I was reading about it, and it said when we've done something a million times, we put labels on it and we assume that we know everything about it. So you've seen the trees in your garden a million times, but just take that away and look at them.
Yeah.
They're still beautiful.
Have you actually seen them?
Yeah. Have you actually taken time to look at the colours, how amazing it is that that tree is that way? I just think that that's amazing.
I've got and I mentioned this in a podcast I did the other day of a friend who's into Buddhism, and he said, imagine your mind is a train station, and that your thoughts are the trains coming in and out the station, and you're stood on the platform, and sometimes the trains will just fly straight through, and sometimes the trains will stop. Secret is not to get on the train. And that was basically, yes, you're going to have thoughts, but just let them go. Mm. Don't hold on to them.
What about if there's a train crash in your brain?
Yeah.
Quite often.
We're all saying the same thing, aren't we? Whatever philosophies people follow, it's about turning off those thoughts that are just intrusive constantly, over and over and over again. I mean, I catastrophize quite a lot.
Me too.
The what ifs, you know, which wasn't good when you spent 2 years in family protection, safeguarding suspects and victims, and you're going through the scenarios. What if this happens? What if that happens?
Yeah.
Keep me awake at night.
But is that not something you were taught to do in that area of work? Surely you were trained for the what ifs.
Yes. So that made me a professional catastrophizer.
Yeah. Thank you.
it wasn't a good combination.
No, not at all.
Such was the impact of yoga on your life that you decided to travel to Rishikesh in India, the home of yoga, to undertake your teacher training. Oh, that sounds amazing. Go on, tell me about that.
I was lucky enough because the one plus side of working in social care is you can take sabbaticals. You're not self-employed. So I was lucky enough to get a year off. I was getting, how old was I? Maybe I was 26 at the time. I can't quite remember. I thought, oh, I'm getting a bit old to put off this traveling anymore. I'm going to go and do it. So me and my friends packed a bag and left. We did quite a lot of traveling before the yoga. But before I left, because I knew that yoga was such an amazing thing for me, I had already pre-booked my yoga teacher training at the beginning of the year. After a good couple of months, I travelled over to Rishikesh. So it's in North India, right in the Himalayas. Oh my goodness. It was stunningly beautiful. It's an experience like no other, really. And, you know, it's a cliche to say these things, but it did change my life. I met some people there that I am still very, very, some best friends. It's a month of very, very deep work. And I think that I went there not wanting to be a full-time yoga teacher. I went there just wanting to find a deeper practice. And I think a lot of people do that. If you're lucky enough to have a month that you can take, and I know a lot of people don't have that, I would highly recommend going and doing it. Even if there is no want to teach yoga, you will find out so much about yourself. Lots of tears, lots of laughter, lots of times where you think you can't do something. And this isn't just about asana. You know, there is, you do lots of asana every day, but you do lots of meditation, you do lots of philosophy, you do lots of breath work. It's a kind of a finding yourself mission.
You're describing that, and straight away I'm feeling a bit scared about that.
Oh, really? Why?
Well, you said about finding out about yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody's personality, there are things that perhaps we don't want to look at. Oh, I think that's a scary bit.
Yeah, it's very scary. It's the realisation that, oh, okay, I am a bit of a nut job. You know, the yoga teaches you the acceptance of that. We are what we are. We can't change it. I've been trying to change myself for 37 years and I haven't. I can't. I am who I am. And I think that that's kind of what I always try and instill as a teacher anyway. And just as a person, I am who I am. I struggle. I have anxiety. I have diagnosed OCD. I am not perfect in any way, shape or form, but that is part of me. I can get by with these things, but there are days where I hate life and there are days where I absolutely love it. Mm. And
I think it's, they say, isn't it, the qualities that will really improve your life are gratitude and perspective. Mm. And all the flaws that human beings have, and we call them flaws, but you could also argue, well, that's what makes human beings beautiful.
Yeah, it's not a flaw. It is what it is. You know, I got diagnosed with OCD about two years ago now. And like I said, my mum has always said, from me being a young kid, there's always been something quite like, you've always struggled with balancing your emotions, with certain things. You've always kind of gone low mood, high mood, whatever. I remember I went to this counsellor and she said, you've got OCD. You need to go to the doctor and tell them to look at your history and put the pieces together. And I went to my doctor and he said, yeah, you do. We need to sort this out. And I was like, how have you not put this together firstly, like before this? When I went home to my boyfriend and I said, oh, I've got OCD, I think. Like, they think I've got OCD. And he said, well, that makes a lot of sense. Because I didn't know, had I have known 10 years previously, that OCD isn't just organizing things in an organized fashion. You know, I had a viewpoint where, well, I didn't know about it. So it isn't just about organizing things in certain places. It's about intrusive thoughts. It's about if you don't do a certain thing, then Nathan will die. Or if you don't lock the door in a certain way, lock it over and over again, go back to the back door, front door, back door, front door, back door, the dog won't die. And I said that to my counsellor and she said, yeah, some people do check the door, but there's no intrusive thought behind it. My boyfriend said to me, can you not do that? And I said, no, I have to do it because of this. And he was like, God, that must be so hard.
Exhausting.
Kind of bringing it back to the yoga and what's really important for me and what it taught me, either my first yoga teacher training, it taught me about myself and how I am who I am and I can't change that and being okay with it. And I try. I'm not 100% on that, but I try.
Now, it seems life has come full circle for you with over 10 years of teaching experience, I believe, and 15 years of personal practice. You've just opened your own practice in Bispham.
I have.
Sounds very exciting.
It is. It's been a long time coming. I opened Agni, we're called Agni Yoga, Agni meaning fire. I opened on the 27th of April. So we've just been open a month, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's my own yoga studio. I've been looking for a studio space of my own for maybe 3 or 4 years. And for those that are in the commercial renting space, they'll know that that is a hard thing to find. And one came up finally after all the looking. Some people told me I was crazy because the market at the minute is mad, but you have to see, don't you? And it's going really well. It's a wonderful thing. All I wanted to do was, so I've been teaching in this area now. I moved back to London in 2019 and I was teaching part-time and then I went full-time in, I think, 2020. And I have been building a community of yogis, of people in the area. And it is so nice to be able to invite them into a home and for us to have a space that is ultimately all of ours.
Personally, I know that several years you've worked very, very hard and you have built up a good, solid client base. And I think that's probably why your business is the success that it is, because you've not started cold there.
No, I haven't started cold. I don't think you could. Would it ever succeed if you did? I had to build it first because I am the kind of person that will, you know, I won't stop. If I'm going to do something, I'm going to put every part of my being into it.
And I think what you've done over the last few years, because it is that sort of work, is that you've built up trust with the people that come to your classes.
I hope so, yeah.
I'm sure that you have. So what sort of things are you offering now?
Well, we're a full yoga studio. We offer a full timetable across the week of different variations of yoga, so different yoga asana styles. We have Hatha, we have Ashtanga, we have Rocket, Mandala, yoga for menopause. What I wanted to do was make sure that I was offering a space for everybody. And as you know, I know that I teach a very physical practice. I teach a lot of Rocket, which I am very aware is not accessible to everybody. So I wanted to make the space as accessible as possible. I've got some fantastic teachers with experience in so many areas of their lives that they can bring into the studio, and that opens up the space to everybody. We offer a free class every week. And again, that's purely so that I can make it as accessible as possible. With my background, I know lots of people cannot afford £12 a class. I'm fully aware of that. But ultimately for me, I have to pay the rent. So there's a free class that we do every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. We offer workshops, and Agni will be the base for also the retreats that I've been running for years as well.
You go to India, don't you?
I did. We held a retreat in India in February this year in Goa, which was fabulous. We did Sri Lanka last year. We're doing Mexico in November. And we've got one space left.
They get snapped up.
Oh yeah, they do get booked up really quickly.
Do you find it's the same people that come on the retreats, or do you get a good mix of?
I get a good mix. Some people come again, but others are brand new. You know, it's a whole host of different people, which is great.
If somebody wanted to find your studio, where are you based?
We are based in Bispham on Redbank Road.
And I'm assuming you have a website that people can visit.
It is agniyogastudio.co.uk.
Smashing. Well, finally, and it's a question I ask of all my guests, and with the multitude of experiences that you have collected over your life, is there a single moment in your life where you've learnt more about yourself than at any other time?
Well, there's been quite a few. I think being signed off from work was a huge indicator of how my mind fails me sometimes and how I need to look after it. And it was a very negative experience, but I've never let it happen again, which changed my life. I'll never let myself get to that point again. One of the other things, and I was thinking about this last night, anticipating what was going to come up today, I did a Vipassana course. Have you heard of Vipassana?
No.
So it's 10 days of silence. And they're all over the world. It's a style of meditation. And I signed up, and it was during the midst of all the craziness when I was working down south. And you go and you are silent. But not just silent, you're not allowed to look at anybody else. You're not allowed to read. You're not allowed to write. You're not allowed to speak. You're not allowed to listen to music, no TVs. You're not allowed to do any exercise, no practice in asana, nothing. You can go for a walk once a day around the garden. And on day 10...
When you were climbing up the wall.
During this time, you are learning this style of meditation, which is mind-blowing. But I remember I came out at the end and I called my mum, because you're obviously not allowed contact with it, no phones. And she said, how do you feel? And I said, I've got nothing in my head. Nothing. So that I can have nothing in my head. Yeah. And there are people who have nothing in their head. And I thought, wow, I really need to work on my...
Yes. Well, that's a great way to end the podcast. Charlotte Goodale, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for having me.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.